Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the President's address on Afghanistan tomorrow, where he's expected to announce the withdrawal of 10,000 troops from a war the American people increasingly see as a lost cause. The former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA, who also served as CIA station chief in Kabul, Graham Fuller, joins us. Then we will speak with professor of law at the University of Chicago, Aziz Huq, who wrote an op-ed in Monday's New York Times, Defend Muslims, Defend America. We will discuss the racist paranoia behind the ludicrous rash of bills in state legislatures banning Sharia law, following the lead of Oklahoma. In addition to the obvious insult to America's core values and a violation of the First Amendment, we'll examine the consequences of these discriminatory laws in terms of their adverse effect on our national security. Then, with two Nebraska nuclear plants threatened by the rising floodwaters of the Missouri River, we will look into nuclear safety in the United States following the recent disasters in Japan and an expose by the AP accusing the Nuclear Regulatory Commission of weakening safety rules to keep America's aging reactors operating. The president of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, Arjun Makajani, joins us. And joining me now is Graham Fuller, who's a former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's Kabul station chief and is currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and, most recently, A World Without Islam. Welcome to Background Briefing, Graham Fuller.
Thank you, Ian.
And tomorrow, the president is expected to announce a slight reduction in the U.S. footprint in Afghanistan, removal of, 10,000 troops. When we last spoke, Graham, you suggested that the real problem that the U.S. has both in Afghanistan and in Pakistan, and I suppose to the same extent in Iraq, is their very footprint is the problem.
Exactly. That may sound like an oversimplification, and it may be in some respects, but fundamentally, the American presence, I think, is the biggest source of Muslim anger, discontent, and the source of huge internal radicalization. So I don't see any turnaround. I mean, there are all kinds of problems in the area, but I don't see ultimately this problem being turned around until that U.S. Military footprint is gone.
And paradoxically, the footprint in Afghanistan, and of course the Afghan war, the logistics supply route is through Pakistan. And I take it that the collateral damage, if you will, of our presence in Afghanistan has been the destabilization of Pakistan, which, frankly, is a far more serious domino, if you will, isn't it?
Well, exactly, Ian, and that is my biggest concern. Of course, Afghanistan matters to some extent, but the major issue the U.S. has had there, namely the presence of al-Qaeda, seems to be considerably taken care of. It's never going to be permanently taken care of, no matter what. But yes, Pakistan is by far the more important country. It's population many times larger, geostrategically positioned, much more advanced, and of course, as everyone knows, possesses nuclear weapons. So that is what worries me. I see the United States essentially driving Pakistan every year into greater and greater position of extremes and exacerbating radicalism within the country that's become now exceptionally anti-American across the boards, including through the military. So I think the collapse total radicalization of Pakistan is a very grave threat that we are running and that I think the U.S. is helping bring about.
So in effect, the Pakistanis basically say they're the ones that are bearing the brunt of the U.S. war on terror. And we tend to dismiss that and talk about their duplicity and how they sheltered bin Laden or who knows whether he was an ISI asset. And there are countless stories. And I've talked to a lot of people who feel that the Pakistanis are stabbing us in the back at every turn. You're, on the other hand, saying, no, we're the ones that are essentially destabilizing Pakistan.
Well, for one thing, the radicalization of Pakistan was not anything like this. If we go back 10 years ago, there have always been certain sensitivities religious movements is strong in the country, but it was only with the Afghan war that suddenly you found radical movements with radical elements, including al-Qaeda, being pushed into the border areas over into Pakistan. But much more important, Ian, really, is that the fact is the element of Pashtuns and the Pashtun nationalists. The Pashtuns, of course, are the Taliban in Afghanistan, and most Taliban are Pashtun. But there are twice as many Pashtun who live just over the border in Pakistan. So anything that goes on relating to the Pashtuns within Afghanistan is immediately and directly reflected in Pakistan. Pakistan is essentially trying to keep the lid on in this very contentious, difficult border area, the Northwest Frontier, as it's called. And they've managed pretty well ever since the foundation of Pakistan. But with the failing U.S. efforts within Afghanistan itself and the inability of the U.S. to deal with the Taliban within Afghanistan, we've essentially turned to the Pakistanis and said, it's your problem, you solve it, you have to put the screws on all of these people from your side. Now, Pakistan is going to have to live with Afghanistan no matter what. This is the only country on it's on the other side of its border. One side is India, this giant 800-pound gorilla, which is a threat to Pakistan. They feel they've got to have an Afghanistan that is in friendly hands. And because of the position of Pashtuns in Afghanistan, that their ability to get along with them, whether they're Taliban or not Taliban, is central. So that's where it really comes down to. Pakistan cannot afford to see a hostile anti-Pashtun regime in Afghanistan.
And essentially, you're saying that the delicate relationship they had with the Northwest Frontier, which was always somewhat unresolved, where we are the bull in the china shop there.
Well, that's exactly right, yes. And so we've seen extreme radicalization within Pakistan only since the Afghan war, and particularly since the U.S. began to put the screws onto Pakistan. So you find elements within, huge elements within the military who are very nationalist, and they are also Muslims. They see Islam as basically the founding ideology of Pakistan. I mean, Pakistan was created as a Muslim homeland out of refugees from India. So Muslim refugees from India. So, of course, Islam features highly in their own sense of nationalism and their identity. If the U.S. is essentially asking Pakistan to crack down on every single religious element that has essentially supported the Pakistani state in the past, then, of course, you're heading for a real problem. If there was no war in Afghanistan, this wouldn't be going on in Pakistan.
Again, I'm speaking with Graham Fuller, who's the former vice chairman of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's station chief in Kabul, Afghanistan, and is the author of A World Without Islam. And let's turn, if we can, since the president is making this announcement about withdrawing some troops, not that many, but he is certainly losing congressional support on both the Democratic and the Republican side. But it's sort of more interesting in effect, isn't it, Graham Fuller, that the Republicans seem to be more and more turning against this war?
Well, this is what I find quite astonishing, and it's really just in the last month or so that you begin to see clear indications of this. I've puzzled for years why there has been no significant discussion within the United States at a time. You know, we have great debates about whether we can afford Social Security or can afford medical care for everybody, but nobody ever touched the sacred cow of military expenditures. I mean, as you know, the U.S. spends more on defense than all the rest of the world put together. So I'm delighted in the end that maybe now discussion is turning to examine the costs of these disastrous overseas wars that are highly expensive, bleeding is dry, and we're losing them all. So and making the problem worse. So any discussion that revolves around bringing U.S. troops back and demilitarizing our approach to the terrorist problem, I think is welcome and long overdue.
So do you think it could end up, ironically, and John Huntsman's just entered the race, although he may have a hard time getting the nomination because of the Tea Party controlling the primaries. If he were to get the nomination, I think he'd be a formidable challenge to the president. But essentially, the Democrats, unless they come up with a narrative here, they're going to look like idiots. They're the ones who inherited Republican wars, and then the Republicans turn around and become the anti-war party. You know, they're going to look really stupid, aren't they?
Very much so. I mean, it would be the supreme irony if that's happens, but I think it very much well could if it becomes a popular movement. Obama, I think, really only strengthened his presence in Afghanistan because he felt exposed in his strong opposition to the war in Iraq. He felt he couldn't be seemed to be a weak pussycat on both issues, so he chose to go after the more just, as he saw it, the more just war in Afghanistan. But that's not working, as we know, and I am surprised and basically, as I say, pleased that at last there's some examination of the war. It's not because it's a war. I mean, one can be more or less in favor of the use of military forces under certain circumstances, but when it's been used exceptionally badly and we're losing and making the situation worse, then it's time for Congress and everyone else. I'm sure Obama understands this, but he's been maneuvered into the position as commander in chief having to listen with some respect to the Pentagon wishes on this, and Pentagon basically doesn't like to back out of wars they haven't won.
Well, the treasure involved is breathtaking. The LA Times just broke a story the other day about how there's something like $6.6 billion, literally, that nobody can find from Iraq. And now the Iraqi government is saying, no, wait a minute, it's a whole lot more. And by the way, it was our money that was deposited abroad and came back as cash and disappeared. But as bad as that is, the amount of money that's been poured into Afghanistan is astonishing, given how poor that country is. If we would have flown over with C-130s and just dropped pallets of cash on these mud brick villages, we'd be better off because the nation building has not worked. I mean,
that's right. It has not worked, but partly because the nation building has been at gunpoint. And I find it sometimes astonishing that we Americans who fought a revolutionary war against occupation by our cousins, the British, find it very difficult to understand why other foreign countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Iraq, etc., should be very hostile to foreign troops, foreign boots on their soil, which they view as occupation. So that's been the kiss of death to almost all reform programs there, and that's why I say it's not going to begin to start getting better until at the very first step, namely the removal of troops, takes place. Now, the obvious rejoinder to that is, well, isn't it going to be very chaotic if that happens and things could end up very messy? All I can say is they're already exceptionally messy, and if you accept the fact that foreign troops are radicalizing the population even more, you know, they're giving strength to the Taliban and other radical movements who say, look, we're here to fight this foreign occupation. And it's very hard for moderates to come out and fight that. They say, yeah, well, right, there are foreign occupation troops here. So I would like to undercut these radicals. They won't have much to talk about once the U.S. forces are gone. There will be a much more open political struggle and competition, I would argue.
Well, but a lot of analysts will go back to the status quo ante, where there'll be a civil war. I mean, a lot of people argue that it's already a surrogate war between India and Pakistan, and India has apparently put in investments, and I'm sure their intelligence people are in there. They've opened all kinds of consulates. Whatever the extent of India's meddling in Afghanistan, from the Pakistani side, it seems it's probably deeply exaggerated. So Do you buy that notion that, we're spectators?
Yes, I mean, there is a surrogate struggle competition going on in Afghanistan between Pakistan and Indian forces. But look, I mean, one of the reasons that we find the whole Kashmir issue also exacerbated at this point and radicalized is because of the presence of war and radical militias within Pakistan. Now, some of them have been there for quite some time, but the fact is their prominence and their role has gone up. I think once the area can begin to calm down, I do believe that the Indians and Pakistanis can ultimately begin to solve these things, but not in the hot breath of war, this cauldron that's just churning up, turning up the temperature all the way around on all political sides.
So would it therefore make more sense then that if the U.S. made a diplomatic effort to engage the neighbors, given the specter of a resumption of civil war, if there's a strategic vacuum there, if we just pull out? We, of course, don't want to talk to the Iranians, but they have interests there. Russia in the stands has interests. China has copper mines that the United States military are protecting. What an irony, you know.
Yeah.
And then you've got Pakistan, of course. So you would think that if you could engage the regional players in wanting to stabilize the place, it would make sense.
Well, certainly the region does not profit from this kind of polarization. I would argue that because of the military situation raging in Afghanistan next door and now flopping over the border, it means that what needs to take place is a demilitarization, essentially, of all of these problems. It doesn't mean that they're going to be easy or that everybody's going to start loving each other once military boots are removed. But it does mean that the competition can take place on a more political level when heads are going to be calmer. The Taliban will no longer be in a position to be fighting against the foreign occupation of Afghanistan as they see it. And I think there's much more room for agreement. I don't think India and Pakistan are going to fight to the death over Afghanistan at all. But given the war going on there, they've both moved in, for sure. But Pakistan will always be concerned that Afghanistan remain somewhat friendly to Pakistan because it's on their southern border. It's as if the U.S., as if Canada were U.S. worst enemy. The U.S. would be extremely concerned that its relationships with Mexico at the same time be good.
I see. So you don't think it's inevitable that the Northern Alliance would reform and the Pashtuns there'd be that divide that we had before 9/11?
Yeah, I do think I think that struggle will continue. It's sort of built into the situation, but there's been long conflict and competition between the Taliban elements and the non-Taliban elements within Afghanistan. What needs to happen is, as I say, for that to be moved away from the sort of war and terrorist means and to turn more towards political goals. And people who watch the Taliban within Afghanistan today acknowledge that there is a younger generation. They've learned something. I don't think they're still going to be lovable, cuddly people, but they're going to have a major voice in the country no matter what once some settlement is reached. They're almost the majority of the population, not quite. So they have a stake in the future of that country. They have a stake in whether foreign countries can come in at their request to do the kind of construction work that is required as they wish it and not as imposed upon them by foreign forces at gunpoint. So I think we will see a slow change in the character and nature of politics within that country. And that it's going to be slow, but it's not going to happen until the war and boots, foreign boots on the ground in particular, are removed.
So we've lost the war, but that doesn't mean that we're going to have the short withdrawal of 10,000 that the president's going to announce tomorrow. but it will take a long time. And I guess given that we've already lost this war and we've lost the other one, your point is, Graham Fuller, that we should be really having a national debate about here is what are we doing with our military and why are we bankrupting our country and not even winning these wars? And since the evidence is so manifest, do you think this will happen?
I think it's going to take a while, and it's going to take a realization of the hideous cost of being the world's sole superpower and the world's sole policeman. I mean, I think, you know, we came out of the Cold War with that feeling that we were the world's sole superpower, and therefore it was going to be the American century coming up, if we can believe that, looking back. That's what we were talking about a decade ago.
Well, that's what the neocons tried to sell, didn't they? They said, now's our chance to strut our stuff because we control the world.
Well, exactly, but it's very costly, and basically foreign countries resent external intervention everywhere, and I think that's the first lesson to be drawn. We have to decide what is really absolutely vital to our interests, and just because a country is of concern to us doesn't mean that we have to be in a position to appoint its leadership. I mean, China is not what we exactly what we would like by way of a kind of government, but we know that it's a solidly ensconced government, and we're going to have to live with it and deal with it and work with it. This is going to be the future of the world. It's going to be multipolar. There are going to be checks and balances around the world so that any individual single country can do its bidding as it would wish. I would argue in the end that's probably a safer world than one in which one sole superpower or even two superpowers are duking it out for dominance.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Graham Fuller.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you.
And again, I was speaking with Graham Fuller, who's former vice chair of the National Intelligence Council at the CIA. He also served as the CIA's station chief in Kabul, and he's currently a professor of history at Simon Fraser University. He has lived and worked in the Muslim world for nearly two decades and is the author of numerous books about the Middle East, including The Future of Political Islam and, most recently, A World Without Islam. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with Aziz Haque.